Welcome back to Film Posers for Boricuas ranting, raving, and reviewing cinema. Today, we'll be talking about Blade Runner 2049 for another segment of Film Breakdown by the Posers. And our moderator will be none other than the Blade Runner 2049 stan, Gabriela Burgos. Take it away.
Yes, hello, it is I, the Blade Runner 2049 stan. Those of you who are frequent listeners of our podcast will know this, that I am a huge fan of this film. It is one of my all-time favorite films. So when the option to do another film breakdown episode came up, of course I suggested Blade Runner 2049 so that all the posters would finally watch it. Hehe.
Suggested, in air quotes.
Anyways, my plan worked. All the posers watched Blade Runner 2049. So before we get into their initial reactions towards the film, we're going to talk a little bit about the film and like its background. So Blade Runner 2049 is a 2017 neo-noir science fiction film directed by Denis Villeneuve. And it is a sequel to the 1982 film Blade Runner that was directed by Ridley Scott. And it is based on the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. Now, Blade Runner 2049 stars Ryan Gosling, Harrison Ford, Ana de Armas, Sylvia Hoeks, Robin Wright, and Mackenzie Davis. And the events take place 30 years after the first film, and a new Blade Runner, LAPD Officer K, unearths a long-buried secret that has the potential to plunge what's left of society into chaos. K's discovery leads him on a quest to find Rick Deckard, a former LAPD Blade Runner who has been missing for 30 years. The film was nominated for the 2018 Academy Awards, where it won Best Cinematography, and it was Roger Deakins' first Oscar, which I'm honestly shocked that that was his first win. Anna, what do you have to say about that? Since you are the fellow Deakins fan as well.
I gotta say, it was my first time watching this movie, and I was just in awe with the cinematography. It was beautiful. I really loved the shots, especially the third act where he goes and finds Deckard. I thought it was beautiful. Those shots with the lighting, I loved it. And I was honestly surprised when I found out this was his first Oscar win.
I was surprised as well, but he won, and he won for a good film. So Blade Runner ended up winning the technical awards at the 2018 Academy Awards, which were cinematography, visual effects, sound mixing. So very well deserved. So yes, that is a little bit about the film. And sadly, even though it was received with positive reviews, it was not a box office success. So the future of the franchise, we don't know what's going to happen. Yes, Josie?
Yeah, I actually remember pausing the movie halfway through because I was like, wait a second, I will not be able to finish this film if I do not know if it won any awards. And I'm glad it did, or else it was going to, my laptop was not going to meet a positive end.
Yeah, thankfully it did win that year. I was full on campaigning for this film back in the day, obviously. So, posers, now that you have finally watched, and I don't need to talk about my feelings towards this film because I feel like they have been left very clear in multiple episodes. So I'm just going to let you take the floor and tell me about your initial reactions towards this film.
Okay, so as I said, it was my first time watching this film. I didn't know anything about Blade Runner. I haven't even watched the original one. And yes, I loved the cinematography. I was awed by it. And then it is accompanied by Hans Zimmer's beautiful and godly score.
He took us to church.
He took us to church. We were praying, okay?
Yep.
I remember I texted Gabriela while watching the film. Hans Zimmer said, I'm going to create an environment that is so godly.
the accuracy. Actually, the score for this film is one of my most played Hans Zimmer scores next to Inception.
It's so good.
It is so good. It embodies what, like, the dystopian feeling of the movie. I loved it.
It mixes synth wave, but it doesn't sound like anything else we've heard that goes along those same lines. It sounds so unique. It's one of the, like, when we were talking about original scores for the, I mentioned, you know how when you hear the Minari score, you know it's from Minari. You hear the score from Blade Runner and you know it's Blade Runner.
Yes,
definitely. I did not expect the dread and the existentialism of this movie. This is depressing. Especially the main character, he goes through a lot. I felt sorry for him.
Yep. It's part of the journey.
It's part of the journey, and the plot twist, I was like, damn, bro. It keeps getting worse for him. But I enjoyed it. The only thing that I felt was the pacing. Because this movie is very long. I wasn't expecting it to be so, like, almost 3 hours. And sometimes you feel it, especially, like, in the second act. So another thing that I really like was the world building. And I noticed that there was a lot of Asian themes all around it, which I thought it was very interesting. And I also loved, I don't know why, but, like, with when it came to the world building, there was a lot of commercials around it, and they were selling products that the world does, and I just thought it was so interesting. And, like, for an example, like, I don't know who she was, but there was, like, a giant ballerina, like, in the middle of a town. I was like, that was interesting. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. Basically, the world of Blade Runner is a world filled with ads and promoting products and the latest technology. And I've always thought that we're getting very close to that type of world, considering everything has ads and, you know, how social media tracks what you've been looking at and then gives you ads to for you to buy it. So I don't know, it's kind of eerie how we're kind of at that point in the Blade Runner world. And technically we are in the Blade Runner era, because the 1982 film takes place in November 2019. We're in the middle of it. And this year, the events of June 10th, 2021 will happen. So we're technically in the timeline here. So it's kind of cool when you think about it.
Yeah, and the other aspect I found very interesting was the replicants, that you don't even know if they're actually human or not. And it's so hard for them to find out, and the only way you can find out is, like, throughout questions. But sometimes they can, like, there's a way that, there's a distinctive way that can you know if they're lying or not. I just found it very interesting. That's something I haven't watched in a film.
So overall, you did like the film?
I liked it, and I liked Ryan Gosling's performance too.
Great. I love that for my agenda.
Of course.
Thank you. Huang.
So this is my third time watching Blade Runner 2049. I still love it. I remember last year Gaurila was on her Blade Runner 2049 six-time watch agenda. Good. And she was like, you have to rewatch this. And I'm like, all right, I'm down. You know, it's a lockdown vibe. Let's go. And it's still a trance that I enjoy being on. I do agree with Anna about the pacing. But at the same time, I was so, like, visually, like, amazed by what they presented that I'm like, I can forgive it. I'm having kind of fun. And what I love about it is that I'm realizing on the third rewatch, it felt like what a Blade Runner sequel should be, and not a film that relied on a now typical Hollywood franchise formula. And it has a very sci-fi neo-noir aspect to it, which I love. The cinematography and visual effects are fantastic. I thought Roger Deakins had already won a couple of Oscars by the time he got to Blade Runner 2049. I am today years old finding out that this was his first Oscar. But also, what a great way to win. Like, your first Oscar, Blade Runner 2049, for that work. Like, hats off to Roger Deakins again. I love seeing the technology in this world. It's, again, aesthetically pleasing. And I did see the first film a while ago. And I love what it took from that film and adapted and updated for this film. I like that Denis Villeneuve didn't just cast aside everything Ridley Scott did. He wanted to pay tribute to it and say, I don't want to make my own version of a Blade Runner movie. I want to make a sequel that I feel Ridley Scott would feel proud of. And I appreciate that, because a lot of directors sometimes want to make their own versions and, you know, to each their own. But I like that for a property like Blade Runner, they wanted to stay as true as they could to the original while updating it.
Yeah, and Ridley Scott was actually a producer in the film. So obviously that helped. Better.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And as for the box office bomb, yes, it lost over $80 million. Unfortunately, this was also released around the time of Hurricane Maria. For us here at the Posers, we couldn't see it on a theatrical screening.
I still cry every day over that.
I know, I'm sorry, but we had to bring it up for the audiences. And if we had the chance to see it in a theater, I'm sure the numbers would look differently. Like, I feel like it was, could have been the right time, but wasn't.
Re-release it before Dune, you cowards.
Make it a double feature on IMAX. Double
feature. I will sit through it. 6 hours. I will sit through it.
I feel like she'll take us with her, but I'm down. So, yeah, love it. Denis Villeneuve, he definitely understood the assignment. I still think it holds up.
He did understand the assignment. He did that for us. He and Hans Zimmer really went above and beyond for this film.
Yo, that score, I swear, I felt the first time I watched it, the score was like, I was so into it and loving it that I didn't pay attention to like the screen. I was just like vibing with the score. It's a vibe. And then I came back to the movie and I was like, wait, what happened? And then I figured it out. So I was good. But it's a great film. It's on HBO Max. Highly recommend if you have not seen it.
Yay. Two posers have liked the film so far. This is how I win.
Finally. And I have 5 stars. 5 stars on Letterboxd.
Yes. Perfect. My agenda. Josie, what about you?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, this is my kind of film. So I just fell in love with the cinematography. I love the score. I will say that I think that if it did not have those elements, it probably wouldn't be considered as good as it is nowadays, because it's just a very good formula, like different elements put together to create this final product that just make it what it is. And if you take something out, I don't think it will feel the same. So props to the team that came together to make this film. It's one of cinema's best of the recent years. I mean, you see this film from afar, and then when you finally watch it, it is like, it meets those expectations, and it deserves all the recognition it gets. And yeah, I really liked it. I mean, it lived up to what I was hoping, what the book represents, and I did not have that good of an experience with the first Blade Runner. So I was very pleasantly surprised that I did, in fact, genuinely enjoy the sequel.
My agenda really is thriving with the posters today. Okay, so we're just going to jump in and dissect this behemoth of a film, because there's a lot to unpack when it comes to this film. Are we ready, posters? Are we ready to dive into the existentialism of it all?
Sumba.
As Chloe and Halle say, do it.
Como dice Pitbull, dale.
Okay, so the first aspect is, one of the biggest themes of this film is how Kay is a tragic hero. Because obviously his journey, he starts off as when the truth, it, obviously we're gonna dive into spoilers here, so be wary.
Yes, so, of course, if you haven't seen the film, this is your last opportunity to skedaddle.
Yes. When the conspiracy, the mystery of the film is discovered, it's basically that we find out that Rachel, that's the replicant from the first film, the love interest to Harrison Ford's Deckard, is found, and it is discovered that she had a child. So a replicant was able to give birth. And so the mystery of the film is, who is this child? Is this child alive? Like, the implications of a replicant being able to give birth, it would change everything. So obviously Kay is assigned to find this child and kill it. But as the film progresses, he starts to realize that maybe he is the child of Deckard and Rachel. But at the end, it's revealed that he's not. Therefore, his arc ends up being taking a completely different turn, and he is considered a tragic hero. What do you think that entails? Is it true, or is this just, you know, the plain hero? What do you guys think about his character in general?
So, I thought it was interesting because you see that he is a replicant, and people see the replicants as slaves in a way. There was a moment in the story where a woman says to him, dying for the right cause, it is the most human thing to do. And I thought it was pretty interesting because, other than that quote, another thing that you can find human in him is he chose to do that. He chose to leave what he was doing, that it was just chasing the child, you know, in the comilla, and doing and going in on his own journey. So I thought it was pretty interesting that you go with this hero that at the end of the day, you don't see him getting nothing, kind of nothing in return, but in a way, he gains the humanity. I don't know if you guys entiende lo que estoy tratando de decir.
Yeah, I see it. Because it's very interesting, because actually the name of one of the songs that Hans Zimmer composed, mm-hmm, is called More Human Than Most.
Yeah, it's just that I feel that you can gain your humanity also by choosing your own destiny. And that's the thing that he did.
And there's also,
yeah,
para, and sorry, interjecting, pero también está la línea en donde dicen, more human than humans.
Yeah, and I just feel that it's a change because you see him in the first act following orders, but at the end of the film, he is the one choosing.
My theory with him is that he feels lost himself, as you can tell when he was interacting with Ana de Armas's character. So he desperately wants to believe he's the child, even though in some part of his subconscious he has this feeling saying, what if it's not me? What if I'm not the child? He like needs it to be true, because then his purpose is like, well, then what am I doing here? Like, it's lost. And then throughout the film, he starts to have these human components where he's like, I need to help them, that it's no longer, what should I do for the greater good? What should I do for the greater good? It feels more like, okay, I need to help Deckard. I need to help the girl because I need to do what's right for most, not what I'm being told to do. And he's kind of having this complex, in my opinion. I don't know if it makes sense.
It does. He's gaining his own consciousness in a way.
And even though that he kind of loses his purpose in a way, like the main purpose of the film that it was established, he gains another one. So in a sense, he is a tragic hero because...
Yeah, he sacrifices himself to save Deckard. Exactly. So that he can meet his daughter.
To add to that, he did sacrifice himself for Deckard. And in a way, that is fulfilling his purpose, which makes him more human than most, because most people maybe wouldn't have sacrificed themselves for Deckard. He put his life on the line.
Yeah, and it's also how, you know, he and Deckard had just met and Deckard tried to kill him. So it's kind of him giving his life over someone that he just met and that originally tried to kill him. It's also a very big sacrifice.
Yeah, and it is a way of him gaining some humanity.
Mm-hmm. Josie?
See, that's the thing. I don't think he is a tragic hero. I think he's an anti-hero.
Elaborate, please.
So, an anti-hero usually lacks some of the conventional attributes of a traditional hero. And while their actions are ultimately noble, they don't always act for the right reasons. An example from popular culture that Gabriella will appreciate is John Wick.
Bebe, yes.
Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga.
Well, a tragic hero is usually a character who has heroic traits. That usually they're very sympathetic to an audience. You love them from the beginning, or at least think of them as a hero. For example, Achilles, of course, and then they meet a tragic end, which is what does happen with Kay at the end. So I do think it could be a combination of both, but ultimately I do think it's more of an anti-hero. Again, most of his actions, while he thought he was doing what was right, you don't agree with him. And it isn't until the end that that switch goes into place.
But also, keep in mind that he is being controlled by Wallace. So that his mind wasn't his own. It isn't until the halfway through the film that he starts getting his own consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I still think he's an anti-hero.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, seeing it from Josie's perspective, I can see how maybe he's not a tragic hero per se. I don't see him as a hero. I see him as a lead character who's lost.
Yeah, usually, tragic heroes and anti-heroes will be your protagonist. But I do have a reason as to, I do have a response to Gabriela, but I'm going to let Juan finish real quick.
Oh, I was just going to say, I see him as a lead character, but I see him more as lost. I don't see him as taking charge for the better good to help everyone until towards the end. And I get that we're on the journey with Kay trying to figure out where for him, what's real, what isn't. What is Wallace manipulating from his mind? What Wallace isn't manipulating?
Yeah, and he's an unconventional hero.
Exactly.
We see his journey becoming one. Also, the thing with a tragic hero is that usually their flaws or mistakes are what caused their downfall. But I don't think to say that he's a tragic hero would mean that what caused his downfall were mistakes or flaws, when I think it's quite the opposite. I think he genuinely came into his own and became his own person. And while it was a tragic end, it was for the better. I don't see the ending as tragic, even though he has lost his life, but he has gained purpose and a sense of belonging in the world, and just it's a moment where he finally feels human.
And also, I kind of can't see an ending where Kay makes it out. You know what I mean? I can't see an ending where he moves on. Mm-hmm. It always felt like either Deckard or Kay, one of them, wasn't going to make it to the end, because it was always a perilous journey for both of them. They're both Blade Runners. They both know how it could end. They just don't know when.
Yeah. Which again goes back to saying that he is a noble protagonist, even though, yes, his actions were being controlled, but you do see the underlying humanity again and that subtle kindness underneath him, because even though, again, we like to make fun of Ryan Gosling's unmoving face and emotionless acting, I know we like to make fun of it, but in his filmography, but here it makes sense because he is supposed to be a replicant. But the thing is that regardless of that, you still do see emotions in his eyes, because I love how Ryan Gosling acts, because he acts with his eyes and it's perfect. And from the beginning, you do see Kay kind of questioning all, even if his actions say the opposite.
Yeah, I see it. I agree. But I personally see combined aspects of both an anti-hero and a tragic hero. So, continuing discussing characters, I want the posers to talk a bit about the importance of Joy, which was Ana de Armas' character. And the mostly the scene where Kay sees the ad for Joy, which is like the iconic scene where Ana de Armas is, you know, this big pink hologram. So Joy is basically Kay's companion. She is a like a holographic girlfriend of sorts. She's a product.
Like the typical promotion of companionship.
Kay, So he Kay has one of them and he comes home to her and it's kind of like his companion, but obviously she's a hologram. She really can't do anything. And she couldn't even leave the apartment until he got like an enhancer sort of thing. That's when he could take her with him everywhere. And so there's this constant thing where she's clearly, you know, falling in love with him and she likes him a lot. And she even almost says, "I love you" to him before she is killed by love, which we'll get into that later. But also when he thinks that he might be the child, she tells him that he would have been named by his mother. And so she starts calling him Joe. And then after she is destroyed by love and Deckard is captured and Kay finds out that he's not the child and he's left wandering all alone, you know, he feels very lost and confused, you know, because he thought he had a purpose, but turns out he didn't. He sees the ad for Joy. And that's when he realizes that he's a machine just as she was, because the ad calls him a good Joe. And that's when he realizes that her naming him Joe didn't come from within her. She was programmed to say that kind of thing. So posers, what do you think of Joy?
Okay, so Joy is spelled J-O-I, which I think is interesting. But I think Joy's purpose was to provide actual joy in a joyless world. The future made in Blade Runner 2049 feels at times very grim and dark. In that sense, I feel Joy kind of stabilized Kay because it gave him a sense of normal life, what he could come home to, the typical, you know, relationship of, oh, come home, talk to your wife, all of that. And yes, she was a machine, but it felt real to him, and that's what mattered. So I think her importance was not only to help Kay, but it also showed Kay that, like, hey, you can't hide behind everything that's being sold to you, hence the billboard, which, again, a beautiful shot, the billboard. He, at that moment when he realizes that Joy was a figment of the Wallace Corporation's imagination and creation, he feels lied to, because what he thought he had built with someone, because he had fallen for the fantasy, he starts to doubt everything. He starts to be like, well, that wasn't real, because what is real? What is supposed to be going on? But then also there's that moment where Joy and Kay, when she lights his cigarette, so you're kind of trying to figure out, was it real? Was it not real? Because Joy is arguably like the lie of technology. It's real until you find the quick flaw that shuts down everything you believe in. It's like a fleeting, it's like a distraction that is meant to soften the blow for life in Blade Runner 2049. You know, the lives of someone who is kind of in a lower class, like a medium low class in terms of K, because of the apartment. And in a point, Kay starts to question what his life is. He feels like it's meaningless once he finds out Joy is basically a product and not real life.
Exactly. I think that scene, he realizes that both of them are products, because he just found out that he's not the child of Deckard. Therefore, he has like no grandiose purpose. He's just another replicant whom they're going to keep making kill other replicants, and he has no control over that. Anna, I know you were really upset over this scene, so what do you have to say about it?
Okay, so the reason that I was a little bit upset was because, again, this was my first time seeing Blade Runner, and every time they talked about Blade Runner, they always showed clips of the scene, and I thought it was going to be a bigger scene, you know? But Gabriela sat me down. She was like, here's the tea. So I understood.
Anna finished watching this film, and it was just like 5-minute long voice messages of me breaking it down for her.
I had an existentialism problem right there, okay? Pero que después que Gabriela me lo clarificó, I was like, okay, I get it. So when we first see Joy, the introduction of this character was after Kay had a really rough and long day. And I liked how Joy, generally, like, coming from this dystopian and toned down world, she's the only, like, person that kind of humanized him. But then at the end, she is a product. So it was, I don't know, it was really interesting to see, like, the only person that kind of brought him down and, you know, a little bit of peace, it's also a product that you could say it wasn't even real in the first place. She was built for that. So I feel that it also, it was kind of depressing for the character because we see him going to this journey, and it was, this scene was after the reveal that he had, that he wasn't the child, and it was like the last blow for him. Because the only relationship he built, he didn't even build it because it was real, it was just made up. And I liked how also the name stands for Joy. I don't know, in a sense, that's what he kind of brought him. That was depressing, not gonna lie.
It is. It is very depressing. Jesus. I was just remembering your existential crisis you had.
Uh-huh. When you told me that voice, explaining to me about Joe and how the hologram said Joe, and that was something that it was programmed. I was like, oh, I capté. Ahí yo hice un connect for ahí, like.
No sé qué decir. Because I was under the impression that she had evolved.
I mean, that's a possible theory. Please elaborate.
I just felt that maybe she had evolved beyond her programming.
It could be possible.
Considering how much time they had spent together. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm seeing it as the cup half full kind of scenario. But I actually took that when she said Joe as a sign, because that's when everything clicked for him and he sprung into action. And maybe that could have been the revelation that, yeah, maybe it was part of her programming. But I didn't see that possibility until you guys just discussed it now. I don't know why when she said it, I thought it was, I saw it more as a sign. Because I wanted to believe that she lived on, okay?
I mean, I could see it because there was the scene where she said, destroy this thing in the house and, like,
yeah, so like the antenna. Me. The antenna.
Yeah, because you can see that she took charge, you know? She took
She could think for herself because exactly. Usually the thing with Joy is that they're created to basically be what you want. Etc. But the thing with Joy is that she acted for herself. Most of what she did felt like it was for her own autonomy and as well as for him because, quote unquote, she loved him. And I was reading and I remember that I saw that Villeneuve said that he did take inspiration from Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson in Her. I have not seen it.
Oh, yeah.
I totally see that.
Specifically, he mentioned it with the scene where they have the menage a trois.
Yes.
that he took inspiration from that film for that scene and for their whole dynamic, because essentially she did want to be with him, which is the thing that they're supposed to be, what, again, what you want them to be and just fulfill your desires and everything. But it was very interesting that she went the extra mile to get someone else. Shouldn't their program make them believe that they're sufficient to fulfill what they're made to do? It was just interesting. She was doing a lot of things uncharacteristic to what I believe her programming probably stated.
I see it. I don't know. I think that, I don't know, to me that, I just think about how, you know, when she called him Joe and then he sees the ad, I just see it as he realized that she wasn't real. That's how I've always seen it. But I see your point. And it could be possible. Again, this film is filled with nothing but possibilities when it comes to everything. Again, there's so much to take away from this film. And I feel like we're barely going to scratch the surface of it in this episode, because if not, it's going to be like 4 hours long. Both points are completely valid. And who knows, maybe Villeneuve wants to be optimistic and agree with you.
I mean, at the end of the day, Kay was just being manipulated by everyone and everything in his entire life. So in the end, his final action is his own, which is very poetic.
Which is ironic, because this film is poetic cinema.
Certified poetic cinema. So now we move on. Like, this is very interesting. I actually took note of this in my most recent rewatch of this film, which according to Letterboxd, I'm at number 7.
I'm shocked. I thought you'd be at 9.
So, the next point is, do you think that the character Love had a semblance of humanity?
That lady?
That lady.
She was doing her manicure while she was killing people, okay? Humanity? You want to talk about that?
But you make me laugh.
I am. Let me justify why I bring this point.
Okay, Lavi.
There's a scene where she cries.
So do I.
So do I. I cry at the end of this film every single time. We know that. But there's a scene, specifically when she's with Wallace. And it's right after Wallace found out that there was a replicant gave birth, and so one of his replicants is born, and then he kills it, and we see a single tear escape from her eye. Is Love the way she is because she's being controlled, or if she's simply like that? Is there a redeeming factor to her?
Maybe the reason she had a single tear is because Wallace said that their creations weren't perfect because it couldn't reach that state. So maybe she felt that way because she couldn't be perfect for her creator.
So, therefore, she's not as emotionless as she seems.
No, it's not saying that she's emotionless, because, I mean, she experiences anger and jealousy, but I just don't think she has humanity.
But why?
So, I thought on this third rewatch that while Love is a replicant and, you know, a villain that's, like, designed to follow Wallace's orders, I'm also like, what if, y yo me fui bien, bien en el backtrip para esto, I was wondering, what if she's meant to represent what it's like to be human on a large scale? Like, not just on a personal one, on a larger scale. Like, when she has that tear, she kind of, like, confronts the deep conflicts of character that we're all possessing. And when she couldn't be perfect for Wallace, she feels not only disappointment, but she feels like she's just not good enough. Something a lot of humans experience. And while you can't see it on her face as much, you kind of get the implication of it. And because, you know, Kay's more a hologram, like, he, in the sense of, he goes for a hologram rather than a human, Kay wants to do, wants to have change and catharsis. Love is kind of like a little more human than Kay because it's harder for her to reach catharsis and change. And that kind of arc within the story is a little more human than Kay when you think about it. Because Kay's like self-discovery. Again, me fui en la trip. I could be wrong.
You really went deeper into that than I expected.
Then I'll...
No, yeah, totally. I think Love gets like the bad rep of, oh, she's just like the one of the evil ones. But there is something within her. I think you're going somewhere, Juan. You're going somewhere.
But also, those nails, they came out great.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah, they did.
We love that. Also, never forget how I ended 2020 when I really messed up my bangs and I looked like Love for like a month.
Oh my god, you did.
Yeah, it was.
I kind of thought you did that on purpose, but go on.
No, I did not.
But I was like, oh my god, her Blade Runner era is coming again.
It was an accident, but you know, I looked like Love for like a month. It was a choice. It was a look, but you know. I love that movie so much that I became the film. Josie, you wanted to say something about Love.
Yeah, I just, of course, we're on this journey with her and Kay simultaneously. The problem is that Kay is going towards the good side of what makes a person human, and Love is going towards the negative side of what makes a person human. Yeah, I can't get on that boat with her. Because ultimately, everything she did, even though, again, it's that aspect of, I'm not going to call her an anti-hero, but I can see how people would sympathize with that if they're trying to vouch for her humanity. Because most of what she was doing, she thought was for a greater good, even though ultimately, she was a cog in everyone else's plan. I guess she was everything. She was not good. She feels up to a certain point, but at the end of the day, she will never reach what it truly means to be human because she's not willing to sacrifice beyond what she wants specifically. And that is why Kay gets to reach a point beyond her because he chooses something above himself. Which is the main concept of the novel, which we have all these things happening when it comes to replicants and retiring them, and her Deckard being a Blade Runner, a bounty hunter. But also you have the aspect of religion in this world that carries a lot of people, and this whole aspect of martyrdom, which is what Kay reaches up to a certain point. But she doesn't look beyond something other than herself or what she wants. She doesn't look for a bigger cause as opposed to what Kay tries to accomplish. And yeah, you could argue that the scene when she's like, oh, your first thought of something new is to try to kill it so you can avoid change. But at the end of the day, was that for a greater cause or was that just for her own benefit?
I would say for her benefit. Because she, at the end of the day, all she wanted was to please Wallace. So, of course, she was willing to do anything to please him.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had a sense of duty. And I feel that also that scene, we see her frustrated because she could end up as the woman that Wallace killed.
Yeah, and the scene where Wallace and Deckard meet, that Wallace recreates Rachel and then... Deckard says that it wasn't her because her eyes were green and he just kills her like without any sort of sympathy. That, you know, she sees that she could be next if she's not up to standards with him.
Yeah, I think her own death also speaks volume.
Yeah, it's so funny because...
It's just very animalistic beyond anything.
Yeah.
Also, real quick, Josie mentioned that her death was animalistic. I kind of feel that's full circle because... The first time you see her have like a human like tear is when Wallace butchered the newborn replicant. Yeah. And because that replicant couldn't give birth. Mm-hmm. And Wallace like uses a knife to like open her gut and her womb. And it's like the way you would slaughter livestock. And you could also argue that when Love saw that, it kind of represented like her family or her next of kin. Because she's standing there watching that murder happen and she can't intervene because she's like a slave to her programming that Wallace provided. But she also wants to please Wallace. So she can't save her, even though she has like this instinct of wanting to, hence the tear. And it's like emotional for her to watch because she realizes she could have saved her, but she...
Yeah, because, like, I mean, there's an attachment the same way that in the original, when each one gets killed off, the replicants just get angrier. So there's also that instinctive reaction within their programming.
See? Maybe love isn't so one-dimensional after all. This is what I wanted to bring to
me. I mean, she's not one-dimensional.
I've heard arguments that she is, and after rewatching it recently, I was like, no, you're wrong.
No, she's not.
Yeah.
What a shame, though, she couldn't open up her nail salon. That would have made some money.
Honestly. One.
Tell me I'm wrong. And now, we'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our sponsor, Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast.
So now we are getting down to two of the most important factors of this film. Okay, so my next question. It is about the ending. No, the ending of Blade Runner 2049 is one of my all-time favorite endings. And every time I watch it, I cry. I know. I just can't help it. When I rewatched it the last time, I kept thinking, you know, you've seen it enough times. You know what happens in that scene by memory. Stop it. But no, I still cry. I think it's a combination of both the emotion of the scene and the score by Hans Zimmer. Because I listen to the score from that scene and I cry. So, posers. What do you make of the ending? So, to remind the audience, if you haven't seen the film in a long time, the ending consists of after Kay rescues Deckard from Love from the water and Love drowns, Kay makes it seem as if Deckard drowned so that he can meet his daughter, because up until this point Deckard didn't know that he had a daughter. He knew he had a child, but he just knew nothing else. He wasn't even there when she was born. So they go to the facility because it turns out that his daughter is Dr. Anna Steline, who is the memory maker that makes the memories for Wallace to implant in the new replicants. So Kay takes Deckard to Anna's workplace, and Kay is, you know, mortally wounded. He is dying, but he does not tell Deckard that. He simply lets Deckard, you know, walk in. And he waits outside where he dies as he looks at the sky. It is snowy. It's a beautiful and moving scene. And then the film ends when Deckard sees his daughter for the first time. And the screen cuts to black. And you can see my tears. So, posers, what do you make of this ending? What does it mean, you know, going forward?
Okay, so I did some research after I saw the ending. And I found that Kay, at the end, when he's lying on the steps outside of Anna's lab, like when he's like holding his wounds and he's looking up at the sky, which, again, a beautiful shot when the snow's falling from the sky. It's implied that he's going to die from his wounds. And the music that's playing in that scene is the theme from the original Blade Runner movie, which is played when Roy Batty's final moments were happening. And his time was running out. So I find that interesting because they were both along for the ride and it wasn't their story after all.
In all my years as a Blade Runner stan, I did not know this.
I literally did research on this girl. You should be proud.
Damn. Oh my God. Actually, Roy's death in the original Blade Runner is one of the most iconic scenes, like, ever.
Yeah. So. And also, what's interesting is we just see Deckard and Anna like have a greeting, but we don't see anything past their reunion. So we don't know how Anna takes this news, mm-hmm. which is interesting. It leaves a lot open for interpretation.
I think also a question that could be added to this is, do you think Anna knows the truth of no. her heritage?
No. I don't think she knows, but she was hopeful that someone would find her.
Yeah. Because as she's...
Or, you know, I want to be chaotic.
Okay.
She could know. Because of the way she reacts to the memory. I feel like... Yeah, that she knew it was her memory. And we've already discussed it, but I think the reason why... Like, she looks at Deckard. So, she knew immediately that that was her memory because of the strong reaction she's having. But the way she looks at Kay is as if she wants to tell him more, but she can't because, I mean, she's there. She has to protect her own identity. Nobody knows it. She's the child. The child. Because if she recognizes her memory, and as you said, they don't know where it goes to, but she does recognize the memory again, then that means that she would know that she was a child.
Exactly, but the thing is that she thinks she's fully human because it is established early on that the reason, because the thing about the world of Blade Runner is that due to the environment, due to climate change and wars and all of that, like mm-hmm. the atmosphere's like messed up. So most of the humans have left for Mars, and so she specifically said that she was supposed to go with her parents to Mars, but she got sick because she has a compromised immune system. And that's why she's, you know, in, like, a glass cage of sorts in her lab. Because she can't mm-hmm. have interaction with humans. So that could also be, you know, the ruse to protect her. Because if they were to examine her, they would realize that she's not, like, she's not human.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I want to add something to what Josie said. Because if I remember correctly, when she was explaining that she creates dream like memories, she said that she wants people to smile with those memories. However, the memory that Kay has isn't that happy for her.
It's a sad memory.
No, it's a sad memory.
Yeah.
So why, you know, she didn't create the memory, she had it, because she specifically says she wants to make people smile.
Yeah, real, you're supposed to create them. They're not supposed to be, you know, personal memories. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that maybe, I mean, maybe she does know. And in a way, her making sure that memory lives on him, who knows? Perhaps there are other memories of hers implanted in other replicants. But in case she was caught, maybe having someone else, a replicant with that memory, could also create that doubt of, you know, hey, I'm human, and maybe that would lead to the replicant revolution that's hinted on in the film. Maybe that was kind of like her way to contribute to that uprising.
Because moment there, Kay thought he was human.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when he meets, you know, the group of replicants that in them it is Mariette and, you know, some other characters of the original Blade Runner that they meet, and they talk about how they want to, you know, fight. And so that they stop killing them. And by having Anna, that it would prove, you know, hey, like, we can give life. Therefore, that makes us human. That makes us more human than humans. So maybe that was just her way of contributing her part. Because obviously, again, maybe she doesn't even have the compromised immune system. She's just, that's just part of the play to protect her. Like when they said that they were twins and that the girl had died in the records, when that was false.
Okay, I was going to say, I found interesting that when Kay found out that Anna sold Wallace a memory that ended up being extremely important to Kay regarding the scrapyard, I feel like that's when Kay realized he didn't know who he was. He just lost it there. And it had Anna's birthday on the horse's, like, hoof. But the ending leaves a lot open to interpretation.
Yeah.
It's a lot to unpack.
Release the poser's cut of the 4-hour episode of Blade Runner 2049.
So, going back to Kay's final scene, I feel that in a sense, he, with that, he did thinks that he did gain a little bit of humanity because he cared for another person, and he did what he wanted. And I also feel that he didn't say it to, like, Decker, because what if he said it, Decker would have cared more, oh, I have Kay here and I need to do something because he's dying and he's not gonna go and see his daughter.
Yeah, because at the end he did want, because Deckard kept acting as if he didn't care about his child, but obviously, like, we all know that he did care and that he wanted to know what had happened to his child. So his Kay's sacrifice in a way was to make sure that at least Deckard got to see that wish.
Exactly, because it feels that Decker would have dropped everything to, like, help Kay, because he helped him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because, again, we also don't know how long Decker has left. We don't know his lifespan or anything. Maybe Kay wanted to make sure that at least if he didn't have much longer left, that at least he got to see his daughter.
So, when we first got the introduction of this character, I thought it was so interesting. The concept of her making memories, it was pretty amazing. But I definitely wasn't expecting that ending. And I feel that in a sense, like, she did that on purpose. Like, she did what she first said, oh, it's illegal, but at the same time, she broke the law by sending her own memories to a replicant. Like, in a sense, like, she doesn't know that she is, like, the inspiration and the leader of a what's to come if we get a sequel. She, in a sense, like, she kind of wanted to start something. Or wanted to be known. Because she's there, like, all cooped up with no one to be around with. This is complicated.
How can you two share the same name and don't understand each other?
Ma'am.
Okay, so I think we've pretty much covered about the ending, but overall, did you like the ending? Because obviously I love the ending.
I liked it. I thought it was, in a sense, a proper one. Okay. For the character, it was depressing.
Yeah, it was depressing.
It was depressing, but it hit different.
Josie, did you like the ending?
I think it was the only way it could end.
That doesn't answer the question.
I liked it. I think it was appropriate.
Okay. Now, we're down to the final question, which Josie is dreading. I just know it.
No, I'm not. I am very... I like my answer.
Okay. The biggest question of the... that has been going on since the book was published, since the 1982 film has been published, Reddit threads have been made. Ridley Scott has been asked this question so many times, and he did give an answer to this. He chooses violence. Harrison Ford is asked this, and he always says, I don't care. Very Harrison Ford. The question is, do you think Deckard is a replicant, yes or no? Josie, you start off.
No.
Explain yourself.
No. So, again, as you were mentioning, for example, the book is open-ended. Villeneuve says he'd rather leave it open-ended. He doesn't give an answer. Ridley Scott said, yes, he is a replicant. And Harrison Ford has actually said that no. That's why he plays Deckard with such humanity. And I honestly believe he's human due to the reaction that he has when he sees his daughter.
Okay. Anna.
I do.
This reminds me of that PowerPoint I gave at one of my classes where no one could answer me because I presented so much evidence from both sides.
So I feel that he is a human because there is this one scene where he says that the way that he demonstrates love is to leave everything behind. So he left his daughter behind, and that was a form of love.
Because they also had a plan set. Like, everything was determined, and him staying away was part of it.
Yeah.
And he acts as if he doesn't care, but he really does.
Yeah. And it, that was his ultimate form of love. So, yes, I do believe he is a human.
Oh my god! We were actually in a clubhouse before this, and people were like, Josie, what the heck? He's a replicant. And I'm like, leave me alone. I like to believe in positivity. I just think it's also culpa de Harrison Ford, because again, sometimes he says he doesn't care, and other times he says that that's why he plays with him with such humanity, and you see it in everything he does and his actions and everything. So if he's a replicant, he's just really good at being human, and it's mostly due to Harrison Ford's acting, so it's all his fault.
Okay, so my train of thought is, if he is a replicant, he's probably not the first one to have sex with another replicant to create Anna.
Not and our Anna.
No.
Anna Staline.
Anna Staline, thank you. So, like, if he was artificially created in the first one, we have to wonder how the creator, who is the predecessor of Wallace, I think his name was Tyrell.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. How he manipulated events to bring Deckard and Rachel together. But if this is a world where, like, memories can be manipulated and even implanted, then you go on a trip of, did the events of the first film actually take place at all, or are they fake memories implanted in Deckard as a backstory to motivate him to love and protect Rachel? But if he is a human, again, he could have designed Rachel with the ability to conceive and was waiting for, like, the right human to come along, which would be Deckard. And then there's the baby, who we see at the end, whose name has already been, you know, announced. Presenting both sides of this argument, yes, the human emotion at the end does feel genuine when he sees his daughter. And I do think in that moment you can say he is human. But also, could he be just a really, really advanced replicant to the point where he believes that he is human and that there's no way you can convince him otherwise? Because Wallace also does challenge his perception of whether or not he's a replicant with the way he phrases certain things when he tests him, when he puts Rachel on the stand, like before he kills that Rachel, and he says, that's not Rachel, bet. Because guess what? She doesn't have the green eyes. That's how I know she's a replicant. So I kind of want to say he's human in that scene, because he remembers, not beyond just a memory. So I think I'm going with Josie and Anna.
Oh my god, no puede ser.
Wow, I'm shook. Okay, my turn.
Let me just say thank you for not making me look like an idiot.
No, you're all presented really valid points. Like, I make fun of it, but you're presented valid points. There's all, your points are valid. Hello, this argument is never ending, okay? So we're not here to provide answers. We're here to provide theories.
When you think about it, Reddit fights over this. The screenwriter wrote Deckard is human. Ridley Scott said
he's a replicant.
You all. Because I was also reading, because again, Reddit, if you watch the original cut, it's like it might be implied, but if you watch the director's cut, he is a replicant.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, each iteration of this story is so different, but
it is, it's a lot.
State your case. But okay, the reason I just don't want to be depressed, and we'll get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, 2049 blurs the line between both films in terms of that conversation.
Exactly. That, now here comes my argument. So I have been team replicant all the way until 2017, and that's when Blade Runner 2049 came out. I was team replicant mostly because, yes, in the director's cut, you can see it, because there's like a scene where his eyes shine like the replicant eyes, because that's the thing in the original Blade Runner. When you see the film, all of the replicant's eyes shine. So there's a scene where his eyes shine, therefore it is implied. And then there's also the whole unicorn thing that he's he sees an origami unicorn and he remembers seeing a unicorn, but unicorns aren't real. Therefore, that is an implanted memory that makes him a replicant. There's that. That's why I've always been team replicant. But when I saw 2049, there's a specific scene, and I actually pulled it up to read it. The line, because I did not want to read it, to misquote it. Because when I saw it the first time, I thought, okay, so he's a human. Thinking, you know, in terms of biology, like, how can two replicants conceive a child? Like, I was just thinking in terms of biology. I just didn't see it possible. However, when I rewatched it again, and the scene I'm talking about specifically is when Deckard and Wallace meet face to face for the first time. And Wallace says, and I quote, I have the script pulled up. Did it never occur to you that was why you were summoned in the first place? Designed to do nothing short of fall for her and then and there, all to make that single perfect specimen. That is, if you were designed, love or mathematical precision, yes, no, you are a window to me. And Deckard replies, I know what's real. So basically, Wallace is insinuating that Deckard was created for the sole reason to fall in love with Rachel so that they could have a child. And that child would be, you know, the symbol of hope towards the replicant. Because the thing about the Nexus replicants is that they can pass as human more than the current Wallace replicants. The current Wallace replicants are designed to be more obedient. So Deckard, yes, he could possibly, he and Rachel could have the ability to have a child because they were designed to be more human than the Wallace replicants. So the possibility of Deckard being a replicant and him being designed for that sole purpose is there. But so is the possibility of him being a human that simply fell in love with a replicant.
No sé, Rick. Parece falso. Mostly because when I saw that scene, because you told me to pay attention to that scene, because you just want to burst my bubble, and I was watching it, and I'm like, what's going on? And I just think it was Wallace trying to manipulate him into believing that he was a replicant just so he could be more submissive, because all he wants, I mean, you have, like, if this man created life with a replicant, of course you're going to want to recreate that, and that's his entire purpose throughout the film. Why would he not want to have this person believe everything he says and be submissive to everything he wants? If you manipulate and distort his reality, he will believe what Wallace says from there on. And that is shattered with the whole, her eyes were green.
See, this argument is never ending. I don't know, man. I don't know. See, this film really, you know, ruined my stances on this. Because every time I watch it, I change my mind.
I'm gonna stick to my guns, and people will argue with me, and I'm just gonna stick with my guns, because again, it is purposefully ambiguous.
Yes.
And I just like to believe that it says a lot about, not your state of mind, but the way you view life, depending on what you believe. Because it is a little bit depressing to believe that he is a replicant, because ultimately, something that I read online that was analyzing this would be that if the original Blade Runner by Ridley Scott were to make you believe that the entire point of the film is that he is a replicant, it is depressive to believe that his entire purpose basically was what Kay experiences, which is he's being constantly manipulated by the system, and he doesn't know who he truly is. He doesn't have a moment to actually explore what he is. But we see that in the film. We see the strings being pulled, as opposed to Blade Runner, which just makes it darker and sadder when you realize that if he is a replicant, everything is being pulled behind the scenes, and even we are being manipulated by this film. So it's just very sad. I'd like to believe that he's human, just living in a very sad world, trying to make it through. And these, like, most of these replicants are trying to learn what it really means to be human. But we see kind of the roles interchange, and I just I like that version a lot more. Yeah. It's more uplifting.
Yeah, you really like to be a very optimistic person, and I'm just here like everything sucks and we're all gonna die.
I am a self-proclaimed idealist.
I'm a pessimist, so what can I say?
Can we talk about the real conversation? And that's Deckard's dog.
The dog isn't real. So sad.
The dog isn't real.
What?
What?
Yeah,
it's not. The dog isn't real. That's the thing. All the animals on Earth died.
It drinks whiskey.
Yeah.
Look, I understood when you told me the dog from the Call of the Wild remake wasn't real. But for Harrison Ford to play with my emotions again...
Yeah, the dog wasn't real.
Yeah, it's so funny because when Kay meets Deckard, he sees the dog and he asks, "Is he real?" And Deckard says, "What do you think?" And if you're, because that's not
specifically... No, he said, "Ask him."
All right.
You know what? If he believes he's a good boy, then I believe he's a good boy.
He is a good boy. It's just that
he's a real boy. He's Pinocchio.
Oh my God.
He's drinking whiskey. He wouldn't give whiskey to a real dog.
Exactly. He's had a hard life.
Exactly.
The dog
he's
is
having a sip with the boys, okay?
He's having
a drink with the boys.
He has gone through it.
That's how they prove that the replicants were replicants in the book. Because if a replicant could kill an animal... If someone killed an animal, then they were automatically a replicant because a human, no matter if the animal was real or not, was not capable of killing an animal.
Okay, so mm-hmm. You have there, like, Harrison Ford next to a dog, and exactly. You didn't kill him!
So- Period.
But also, I think, because you could also argue that in the original film, of course, they had the owl and all that, but here it's different because that was more for, like, to determine class mm-hmm. and status, to determine status. Meanwhile, he has the dog in Blade Runner 2049 because he's lonely. He's seeking company.
Yes.
And instead of playing into, like, for example, Kay with Joy, which he wants something easier, more convenient, I don't know, it speaks different to have a dog, because it's also gonna get into Greek mythology. Wow, this episode released the 4-hour cut of this episode. But when you look at Greek mythology, for example, the tale of Odysseus, the fact that the dog waits for him until the end, and once he returns, he dies because his master has finally returned, just speaks a lot to the nobility of dogs specifically. And I think, like, the relationship between man and dog, and even though it is a fake dog, I think there is a symbolism and a metaphor to be said there, which, again, human.
And he was the best dog.
He was a good boy.
He was okay. A good boy.
He was outlived the best all the boy. Other dogs on that planet. What does that say? He is the top tier pooch.
Also, the cross references when you compare how Kay is called a dog and then you have an actual robotic dog in the film. So I think, like, looking at them both is also very interesting. Because Love keeps calling him a good boy, Idolo. So.
I'm sorry, but if I had to choose between Save Ryan Gosling or saving the dog, I'm saving the dog.
So I don't think we're going to have any concrete answers here, obviously. So we're just going to keep this debate going with whether or not Deckard is a replicant or a human. But we did bring up some points. So let us know, which team are you? Team replicant or team human? Posers, is there anything else you want to add about this film?
I just want to say, please be kind if you do end up replying to this episode. Please respect our opinions. I know that saying Deckard is a human is very unconventional, but there are people out there like me, so please be kind.
Well, I just want to say I was personally attacked by Roger Deakins and Hans Zimmer's combo. I wasn't expecting that with a pinch of existentialism. It hits you right there in the gut.
Yes. That honestly, one of my top Hans Zimmer scores. It's just so good. And it hits when you're feeling sad as fuck. Play the Blade Runner 2049 score and cry. Just, it's therapeutic, honestly.
this film is a masterpiece. You should definitely check it out on HBO Max if you have not seen it. And I think we should make it normal to have Hans Zimmer, Roger Deakins, and Denis Villeneuve collaborate on projects together.
Yes, Villeneuve and Hans Zimmer did Dune together, so...
Was our boy Roger busy?
Yeah, Roger was busy. Please, please support my Blade Runner 2049 agenda and watch it on HBO Max.
Yes, it is. Exactly. It's streaming on HBO Max right now, as well as the director's cut of the original Blade Runner film.
Which is the best cut.
So, that's all for today's episode. We'd like to thank you for listening and to give a shout out to all the kind people sending love our way. If you'd like to keep up with us, make sure to follow us at Film Posers on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. Also Facebook. Where can they find you, posers?
So you can find me tweeting daily about Blade Runner 2049 at Gabby_Burgos27. And you can watch how many times I have vlogged Blade Runner 2049 on Letterboxd at Gabby Christina.
So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Anna_Sophia53 and on Letterboxd as Anna_Sophia.
And you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Leading Mohicans. And, you know, you can see some of my takes, which may or may not be controversial, depending on how you take them.
And finally, you can find me at The Josie Marie on Twitter and Letterboxd. Again, thank you for listening, and remember, we're all film posers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.